2 a.m. Welcome back to the 2 a.m. Book Review Club, where we stay up late talking about books or talk about books that made us stay up late. This week, I finally got to read a book I've been looking forward to reading for a long time, and that book is The Once and Future Witches by Alex E. Harrow. I thought this would be one of those books I would read, enjoy, and be done with, but having read it, I actually have a lot of thoughts, and I'm excited to talk about it, in part because I think that talking about the book, talking through my thoughts, will really help me coalesce those thoughts and form a cohesive opinion on this book, The Once and Future Witches. Right off the bat, The Once and Future Witches does one of my favorite things in fiction, which is refuse to adhere to a specific genre. It's historical fiction, but it's also alternate history. It's a fairy tale-esque fantasy, but it's also a satirical take on the very idea of fairy tales and why they exist and who they're about. The Once and Future Witches takes place in an alternate version of the United States, where the witch trials of Salem did not just end in witches being burned at the stake, they ended in the destruction of the entire city. And on the ashes of old Salem, the people built new Salem, a city obsessed with morality and determined to never again allow witches to exist, much less flourish. The book opens in 1893 when the women's suffrage movement is beginning to take off, and New Salem in particular, with its hyper-focus on the dangers of powerful women, finds itself at the front lines of the women battling for the right to vote, and the people who are determined to keep women as far away from real power as possible. At the center of the book are our protagonists, sisters Agnes, Beatrice, and Juniper Eastwood, who have come to Salem to escape memories of their terrible childhood and are all determined to shape new lives for themselves. Though what exactly those new lives should look like are as unique as the sisters themselves. Beatrice, the oldest and wisest of the three sisters, dreams of collecting knowledge, and so she becomes a librarian. Agnes, the middle sister, the nurturing sister who always played the part of the mother they never had, has had enough of a role that she feels has done nothing but backfire on her, and has become a mill worker who is focused entirely on herself and her struggle for survival. And then finally, we have the youngest sister, Juniper, who is wild, reckless, impulsive, and basically the driving force behind the entire story. She is determined not just to win women the right to vote, but also to win back real power for women via witchcraft. Powerful, reality-altering witchcraft that will permanently change the balance of power in society. Because the thing you have to understand about the Once and Future Witches is that it's a story of female empowerment. It's a story of female rage. It's a story that is specifically written for every woman who has wanted to burn the world down and rebuild it from the ground up. Let me read you a quote from towards the beginning of the book. The boy is watching her, head a little tilted. He's not afraid. Why would he be? She's just a young, crippled girl reaching for her cane. He's a man with knuckles white around the weapon. Both of them know how this story goes. For every woman who has experienced this moment, or a moment like it, and wanted the story to end another way, this is that story. This is the book for you. There are female-coded stories, and then there are stories that speak directly to women, and this book is the latter. It's a power fantasy, it's a rage fantasy. It's the kind of book you pick up when you're a woman who has had one too many bad things happen to you and needs to escape to a world where women get together and actually do something about it. Basically, what I'm trying to say is that The Once and Future Witches is a book that is written for a specific kind of reader who is in a specific kind of reading mood. And for the vast majority of that target audience, I think this is a book that they will automatically love. I am in that target audience, but I've read a lot of books like this. Some comp titles that come immediately to mind are Slewfoot by Brum, Cackle by Rachel Harrison, probably also The Southern Book Club's Guide to Slaying Vampires by Grady Hendrix, and I'm also going to throw in We Have Always Lived in the Castle by Shirley Jackson. And so, because I have read many books like this, my standards are inevitably going to be a little bit higher. At this point, my reaction is less like, wow, I relate to this, and I wish I didn't, and more like, I like the idea, but how do I feel about the execution? In order to decide how exactly I feel about The Once and Future Witches, I'm going to break down our discussion into three parts: language, characters, and themes. And that order is deliberate because we will be going in order of things I know how I feel about to things I'm unsure how I feel about. When it comes to The Once and Future Witches, the thing I am most sure about is that I love the language, the writing style. For one thing, the writing style in this book is not just pretty. It's not just lyrical. It has flow. It has rhythm. It has bounce. Here's a line I think illustrates that really well. But all the caring was beaten and burned out of her, and now she's just hate with a heartbeat. The author is very clearly someone who is attuned to the patterns and cadence of language, and it makes for such a memorable reading experience because the author doesn't just say something, she also says it in a way that you will remember. Probably the passage that was most memorable to me personally was this excerpt. James Juniper is just a girl most of the time. The rest of the Sisters of Avalon are just maids or mill workers, dancers or fortune tellers, mothers or daughters. Everyday sorts of women with everyday sorts of lives, not worth mentioning and any story worth telling. But tonight, beneath the rose moon of June, they are witches. They are crones and maidens, villains and temptresses, and all the stories belong to them. This excerpt is a very cliched girl power moment, but hey, what am I here for if not for a cliched girl power moment? This excerpt also nicely segues into the other point I wanted to make about the language, which is that the Once and Future Witches draws heavily on fairy tales. It satirizes fairy tales, it subverts fairy tales, but it also takes them seriously. I mean, it's literally baked into the world building that all of the most powerful witchcraft is hidden inside fairy tales. So many fantasy books published in the last, 5 years or so also play similar games with fairy tales, and it's a little bit played out at this point, but personally, I think that Alex E. Harrow manages to make her usage of fairy tales fresh and fun, and the fairy tales add the mythological weight, the gravitas that this story wants to achieve. I especially loved that every so often, not too frequently, and also not too infrequently, the author will end a chapter with a familiar fairy tale retold in a not so familiar way. For example, chapter 4 ends with this original retelling of Sleeping Beauty. The Tale of the Sleeping Maiden. Once upon a time, there was a king and a queen who longed for a child, but couldn't have one. They tried spells and prayers and charms, but after many long years, the kingdom still had no heir. In desperation, they held a grand feast and invited 6 witches to bless their kingdom. The 6 witches granted 6 fair gifts: peace and prosperity, good health and good harvests, agreeable weather and biddable peasants. But just as the feast was ending, a 7th witch arrived. She was young and graceful and had the sort of face that launches ships and eats hearts. She wore a coal-black adder twined around her left arm and a sharp-toothed smile on her lips. She told the king and queen that since they failed to invite her to their feast, she brought a curse instead of a blessing. One day, a young maiden would prick her finger on a spindle, and the castle would fall into an endless sleep from which no one could wake it. The king took all reasonable precautions. He ordered all the spinning wheels burned and permitted no unwed woman within the castle walls. He kept his throne for 21 years. Until the day a strange maiden arrived at the castle gates. The guards should have turned her away, but it had been too long since the 7th witch had been seen, and the maiden knew the ways and words to make them forget their orders. She wore her familiar, like a black glass necklace, around her throat. The maiden strode unseen through the castle, smiling as she went, until she climbed to the top of the tallest tower, where a spinning wheel waited for her. She reached her pale finger to the spindle's end. There are many versions of this story, but there is always a pricked finger. There are always 3 drops of the maiden's blood. Her blood touched the castle floor, and a spell drifted through the castle. Every living creature fell into a sudden slumber. Pies burned in the ovens, and spears clattered to the floor. Cats slept with their claws outstretched toward sleeping mice, and dogs lay down beside foxes. In the whole castle, only the maiden moved. She stole the king's crown from his brow and settled it on her own head. The maiden ruled for 100 years. She might have ruled forever. Who can say what ways a witch might find to live beyond their years? Except that a brave knight heard tales of a cursed kingdom and rode to its rescue. The maiden retreated to the tallest tower and grew rose briars around it, vicious and sharp-spined, so thick even the knight in his shining sword couldn't cut through them. The knight set fire to the tower instead. As the witch burned, her spell was broken and the rest of the castle woke from its endless sleep. The knight plucked the witch's crown from the ashes and presented it to the king on bended knee. The king pulled him to his feet and announced that he and the queen had finally found a fitting heir. The knight and the kingdom lived happily ever after, although no rose ever bloomed for miles around, no matter how rich the soil or how talented the gardener. And there were still stories about a young woman who walked in the deep woods sometimes with a black snake beside her. I think this kind of thing is a lot of fun, and hey, if Disney wants to continue doing their pointless live-action remakes and retellings, I think they should take notes, or honestly just hire Alex E. Harrow. Clearly, I love the language, its lyricism, and fairy tale inspirations, but I'm a little more ambivalent when it comes to the characters, and this is unfortunate since so much of the book hinges on your identification with and your emotional attachment to the three central sisters, Agnes, Beatrice, and Juniper. It's a little difficult for me to pin down where exactly this ambivalence is coming from, because purely on a writing craft level, these are complex and well-executed characters. They have well-defined motivations and desires. They share a common origin story, and yet they have unique ways of looking at and navigating the world because they're different people with different joys and different pain and different things they want to do and be and accomplish. Agnes, Beatrice, and Juniper are perfect vehicles for carrying the story forward and taking it where it needs to go. But I guess that's why they end up feeling a little bit disingenuous. And here's what I mean by that. The thing about these characters is that it feels like they never ever do or think or say anything that is not in service to the broader story. It doesn't matter if one of the sisters makes a friend or falls in love or gets pregnant or whatever. It only happens because it either moves the story forward now or because it's going to come back later. And as a result, nothing about these characters feels organic or uncalculated. They instead feel like what they are, which is pawns in the story. I think that's why I had a bit of trouble getting into the story, because I just wasn't invested until things actually started happening, until the plot was moving forward, which is really unusual for me. Usually, the opening of the book, the introductions to the characters, everyday life before anything unusual happens is my favorite part of the book. As I like to say, I read for the characters, not the plot. But that just wasn't the case for The Once and Future Witches. It probably doesn't help that I found Juniper, arguably the most important character in the book, to be kind of exasperating at times. She's the wild one, the reckless one, the impulsive one, the one who is either picking fights or jumping into them, and inevitably something goes wrong and her sisters have to step in and save her. I have to respect Juniper for her insane courage, but I think she's just a little too different from me, personality-wise, for me to find her anything other than annoying. If I had to pick the sister I relate to most, it would probably be Beatrice, the bookish one, and I sympathized with her so much when she has this thought about Juniper. The problem with saving someone is that they so often refuse to remain saved. They careen back out into the perilous world, inviting every danger and calamity, quite careless of the labor it took to rescue them in the first place. Say it louder for the sisters in the back, Beatrice. I appreciate these characters. They're well done, but I just couldn't suspend my disbelief enough to connect with them emotionally. And finally, let's talk about the themes. We've already talked about what those themes are: female empowerment, female rage, women's suffrage, and its limitations, etc., etc. But The Once and Future Witches is hardly the first book to grapple with these themes, and while it feels exciting and powerful and uplifting to read in the moment, the more I look back at this reading experience, the more I come back to how The Once and Future Witches essentially boils down to this one terrible guy in this one terrible city, and how cool and amazing the sisters are for defeating him. And sure, they are, but in a book that's imbued with this burn down the world energy, it's kind of an anticlimactic and frankly reductive ending in hindsight. We literally have earth-shaking, world-shattering magic. So why do we not get to see it in action? Why is it that in all the books I have ever read with these themes, I have never once read a book that genuinely burns down the world and shows us what it would look like after it's been rebuilt? Does that book even exist? Because that's the book I would really like to read. Which is not to say that I regret reading The Once and Future Witches, because I don't. By the time I got to the halfway point or so, I was really enjoying myself, and I just flew through the story because I needed to know what happened next. Does this make it an official staying up until 2 a.m. book? Honestly, it could go either way because, like I said, that feeling didn't happen until later in the book. But I will say I did genuinely stay up late reading The Once and Future Witches, so it was more like 1:30 than 2 a.m. So now I've had a chance to work through my thoughts, to organize them a bit, and I think I've decided that The Once and Future Witches was a bit of a mixed bag for me. The things that worked for me really worked, and the things that didn't work for me definitely fell flat. I am incredibly impressed with Alex E. Harrow's writing abilities. So much of my opinion of this book is resting on the power and beauty and strength of the language, and so I kind of want to bring up that quote that somebody said about Taylor Swift, right? Very early on in her career, they were like, great gowns, beautiful gowns. And so I would like to say to this book, The Once and Future Witches, great writing, beautiful writing. I kind of wish the rest of the elements of the book had lived up to the writing. Here's what I'll say about The Once and Future Witches. If you like Slewfoot by Brom, which is a comp title I brought up earlier, it's essentially this story of this woman who is living in Puritan times, and she is basically like an outcast from her community, and they accuse her of being a witch, and she seeks revenge. And so if you like Slewfoot, and if you also like The Last Tale of the Flower Bride, essentially The Last Tale of the Flower Bride is this very much fairy tale infused fantasy about these two girls who are very, very close, and they believe in magic, and they're always searching for magic, and it turns into this toxic, codependent mess. So if you like Slewfoot, and if you like The Last Tale of the Flower Bride, The Once and Future Witches is a lot like the fusion of those two books. So definitely, if that sounds appealing to you, then I would recommend picking up The Once and Future Witches. But like I said, great writing, beautiful writing, nothing particularly groundbreaking about the characters or themes or where the story goes. And that's going to be everything for this episode. This has been the 2 a.m. Book Review Club. Thanks so much for joining me, and I will be back next week at 2 a.m. Until then, have a great week, and happy book travels.